Hey everyone, welcome to More Than Meets These Guys. We have a very special episode this week. We have a guest star with us, Michael Charles Hill. He is the writer of some of my favorite episodes of Transformers, The Gambler, the Starscream's Brigade. You have Bernard Hardness the Bear, The Killing Jar. He also wrote one of our favorite episodes of anything that we referenced a lot on the show, and we just did a review on Cold Slither from G.I. Joe, amongst many other things you've done. So it is a pleasure to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ed, would you like to start us off here?
Before we spin off into a bunch of nerd stuff, we want to know a little bit about Mr. Hill himself here. I'm very curious how you got into writing for television in the first place. Is just doing a search through your IMDb entries, it goes into the episodes of TV that you wrote, but how did you initially get into that whole line of work?
I kind of just stumbled into it. It was never an ambition or goal, you know. As a kid of the early 60s, you know, I watched a lot of Saturday morning cartoons, but you know, it was mostly Looney Tunes or Mighty Mouse or something. And, you know, by the time I got into high school, I wasn't paying attention to any stuff anymore. And I grew up in a very small town in Vermont where loved watching movies. We had a small theater in town that would usually get stuff 6 months after it opened, you know, in New York City. And I used to say that on Saturdays I'd watch, Westerns and war movies and film noirs with my father. And on Sundays I'd watch, you know, musicals and comedies with my mother. But it never occurred to me that that was a job to have, you know, behind the scenes stuff. So eventually I moved to Southern California and then moved to Hollywood with the ambition of being a writer-director. And the first thing I did was I got involved. I started working in film production, mostly TV commercials. And I worked on short film projects with people at film school and stuff. Anyway, long story short, I ended up meeting and become friends with Flint Dillard. And Flint and I had a writer's group that would meet every Monday night. We'd bring in 10 pages of a script that we were working on to distribute to the other members. And then discuss last week's 10 pages that everybody had read and had notes on. And he, thanks to his grandfather, Flint's family owned the rights to Buck Rogers. So Flint and his agent were shopping that property around town to animation studios. And when they got, and everyone turned them down, but at Ruby Spears, they liked Flint. And hired him straight away to write on Mr. T. And probably within a few weeks, Flint calls me up and says, "Hey, how would you like to get paid for writing?" I said, "Sure." So he introduced me to the story editor on a show called Dragon's Lair, which was was still a Saturday morning cartoon on ABC, but based on Don Bluth's video arcade. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So
they only did 13 episodes, but I ended up writing 4 of them. And I thought, wow, this is kind of cool. I don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to be on location at 6 or a soundstage at 6. And I can just stay home and write all day. And so after my stint with Ruby Spears, I started contacting other animation houses and story editors and looking for freelance work. And that snowballed into Sunbow when they had decided to open a West Coast office and take over more creative control of Transformers and G.I. Joe. They hired me on staff to be a writer-producer. So
very nice.
Up in animation.
So, building on that, I have a bit of a background in film. I worked in Los Angeles for a few months years ago. But and I had some. I was more technical, like camera department. But I had some friends that worked that were writers for for television, and which is that is more of a sort of a committee type arrangement when you're writing for sitcoms and that kind of thing. What is it like writing for animation? Is it the same kind of thing, or is it just more of a one man operation for per episode?
It's less than that. You don't have writers' rooms, but you still have. We didn't even call them showrunners. Basically, story editors. So you still have to, whether you're a freelance or on staff, you still have to generate premises or episode ideas that you would submit to a story editor, and hopefully they'll like at least one that you submitted. And you'll get to go ahead to write that. The next step would be writing the outline. Your premises, maybe a page and a half. And then the outline would be 10, 12, maybe even as much as 15 pages, where you break down the story scene by scene, act by act. And then once you get to go ahead on that, then you go to script. So it's less involved, and unlike a live action show, you're not plotting. We were not plotting out the entire season, especially in syndication. And we ran up against this all the time with G.I. Joe Transformers. There was no way that it could be guaranteed that the episodes would run sequentially. So
Hey.
most of the episodes, with the exception of obviously the miniseries and maybe a couple episodes that sort of dovetailed together, they were all standalone episodes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, we actually saw a bit of the non-sequential airing, especially during Transformers. There would be episodes that wouldn't have certain characters that would that had certain characters too early, so it was all a mishmash, and you can kind of figure out how they were supposed to have aired originally. So that's kind of neat to have that their perspective. Ed.
Oh no, that's that. I was done with that part. So go ahead.
Okay,
You
yeah,
have
okay. Well,
plenty.
the whole reason I thought to ask you about coming on the show was was because a week and a half ago we recorded our episode with of The Gambler, which fun episodes. One of the favorite episodes I remember from childhood even. It was really neat because I like TV shows, movies, stories with characters with an odd moral compass. Not they're not white knights, they're not very evil. They're everyone kind of has their own, shades of gray. And so I really appreciated that. But I have to ask you because I've heard stories, I believe from another a panel or something you had done. The name Lord Gaikini, the basically the kind of the mob boss. What I've heard is that that came from some friends of yours at the time, Gary Gygax and Dave Marconi. Can you give us a
That's
little background there?
sure. One of the things that we would love to do is create new names by either changing the spelling of them so they still sounded the same, or mashing up two names. So at the time I wrote that episode, Flint was working with Gary Gygax on a series of Sagard books, and Gary had rented this huge house on this estate at the top of the hill overlooking Beverly Hills Hotel that once upon a time was owned by King Vidor. And it had an old horse stable that was just converted into a barn where Flint and I would set up these chainmail games that we play every Sunday night, but also a couple little rooms for offices. So I was writing the script up there, and David Marconi was a friend of ours. So anyway, yeah, I just took Guy, and it's actually pronounced Guyconi.
Oh, okay. Guyconi.
So,
wow.
Gary Gygax, David Marconi, Guy Coney. Now, what didn't, this was the very first Transformer episode I ever wrote. So it didn't occur to me that I needed to spell out phonetically how the name should be pronounced. And somebody on their own decided it was Guy Coney. And also, I wasn't on staff yet, so I wasn't supervising the recording sessions as I did later on. So had I been in the studio with Wally Burr, I would have corrected. But yeah, that's the story of
I was going to ask if while you were hanging out with Gary, if you actually got to play Dungeons and Dragons, but you threw it way back bringing up chainmail. That's pretty awesome.
Ed and I go back with Dungeons and Dragons quite a bit, so it's really nice to hear that.
Well, I will tell you that the only time in my life I ever played Dungeons and Dragons, Gary was the dungeon master. So
that's absolutely amazing. Very cool.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the most well-known, I guess, tertiary characters in all of Transformers, the original Transformers show, is DevCon. And honestly, it was a really interesting deviation for the classic dichotomous nature of Autobots and Decepticons, you know, being on Earth or Cybertron. And so that was really nice. It was a nice change thrown in there, and it kind of built more backstory about what may have happened. Was there an inspiration for the character?
Well, the truth of the matter is, as I said, it was my first time writing the Transformer. I had written a GoBots earlier, so I'll give you a little backstory. The story I wrote, again, I submitted it, I don't know, 3 to 6 premises. They picked one. And but the story editors had rewritten me enough that I didn't sort of recognize the story. I think the basic premise was there, but they told it differently. So when I was generating premises for Transformers, and again, I didn't really get the Transformers. And so I really struggled coming up with story ideas. Even though I had read the Bible, I had read a few sample scripts that had already been produced. I watched probably a couple episodes, maybe, you know, the first season, it was a miniseries. I still didn't really get it. I didn't know what I was doing. So to satisfy the number of premises I needed, the minimum number I needed to submit, I just threw in the same premise I wrote for the GoBots, and that's the one they bought. So when I was going through the list of all the characters, you know, and I had this bounty hunter character, there were no Transformers I thought that would fit. So I just created my own Transformer, and nobody told me that I couldn't. He said it has to be a pre-existing Transformer or, you know, or a toy. So I just made up my own. And for whatever reason, nobody blinked an eye, not even Hasbro, which kind of surprised me based on sort of the reactions I got from Hasbro once I was on staff, mostly to do with titles that they would object to. And I never, to me, he was just a throwaway character. Tell that particular story. I was making it up as I went along because I just couldn't wrap my head around the whole idea of the Transformers. And unbeknownst to me, he had become a fan favorite. So the very first Transformer full convention that I had done was last year in Toronto. And the night I arrived, I'm informed that Hasbro has finally come out with a DevCon action figure, which, you know, I was simultaneously thrilled, but also at the same time thinking, wow, it only took 40 years for Hasbro to acknowledge his existence.
Yeah.
The other thing is, people have asked me, why did he only appear in that one episode? And I tell people, well, you can blame me, because by the time I was working at Sunbow, was working on the Transformers shows, it never occurred to me to bring him back.
That's actually funny. We brought up in the episode that we would have watched the Slizardo and DevCon, you know, buddy, you know, action show after that, because they were great characters.
Yeah, and apparently another writer, and I don't know why I don't remember this, because I supervised the recording sessions of almost all the shows. Another writer used Slizardo in another character, in another episode.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no memory of it, but I recently discovered that, oh yeah, he's in, I don't remember the name of the episode. I think it might have been one written by Paul Davis.
I think it was season 3 episode, yeah.
Oh, he does show up again?
He does, yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So well, yeah, yeah, Mr. Yeah. I don't know if you're probably not familiar with our show, but the hook of our show is that Evan is a lifelong Transformers fan. He knows, he's like an encyclopedia of Transformers, and I know nothing about Transformers, and so I watch these episodes with a fresh, you know, 40 something year old set of eyes here. So I'm learning this thing as we go along. I was a G.I. Joe kid when I was growing up, but you mentioned Hasbro having oversight over the shows. How did that work? Did they mandate what needed to be pushed in certain episodes?
Yes and no. I periodically would get faxes from Hasbro listing all the new characters and toys that were coming out. And we're going to be hitting a shelf by a certain date. And they would ask us, maybe even instruct us, start writing episodes including these characters, which is how Starscream's Brigade came about. Because when they listed the combiners, I was the first person, at least in our office, to see this information. And so the Combaticons and Bruticus was the most interesting to me. So I said, well, I'll write their story. And I'll create an origin story, because I don't think we were really doing anything like that. But mostly, well, and why I brought them up in the first place, it was also that particular episode where the original title was not Starscream Brigade. It was 30 Seconds Over Megatron. I was a riff off of the old World War II movie.
Right.
And Hasbro, you know, I got another fact saying, no, no, it sounds too much like a war movie. And my first response was, have you guys seen the show? but they would not budge. So I came up with Starscream Brigade, and
they were okay with that, but not 30 seconds over. Okay. All right.
Actually, that's kind of interesting, though. I was like, one of the things I wanted to ask you about during that episode of Starscream's Brigade, which Ed has not seen yet, so it's going to be fun for him. Was it in the show Bible they wanted those characters pre-existing, or was that something you just kind of came up with on your own? And also, on top of that, I kind of get the feeling that because of the original title, you wanted to have the World War II style vehicles being used were really on purpose. And I don't know if that was what vehicles you used were your own purview, or if that was on purpose.
Yeah, no, I chose those. You know, good, bad, or indifferent, those are ones that I chose. Yeah, and the whole Guadalcanal thing, that was all me. That wasn't anything Hasbro. I mean, they had no say in how I would tell the story. They just said, these are new characters. I had model sheets. I had names. Maybe I had a little sample dialogue, but I'm not sure about that. And so that's all I had to go on. So everything else, I just said, oh, I can do something with this. And I just knocked out a story.
Nice. Yeah, actually, they've become some of the longest running favorite characters also in the show, which... Yeah, credit to their. I think their backstory makes them that much more interesting. And I don't want to give it too much away for Ed before he sees the episode, because I'm going to experience that too.
I think that one's coming up pretty soon too.
Yeah, it is. I can't wait for that. But yes, you know, speaking of that sort of thing, though, you know, one of my other favorite episodes that you worked on is The Killing Jar, which will come up in season three. Where did you have? I don't know if you kind of maybe sort of answered this already. Did you have a predetermined ideal of how the characters would react to each other, or did Hasbro have a say, like, we want them to be like this? Because the whole point of the episode was you put in different characters who may or may not like each other into this small area and see how they react to each other. And it really was a good character building episode for season three. So, I mean, did you have a, I guess, guidepost to how to run that, or is that all you as well?
All me. Yeah. Hasbro had no say in that whatsoever. And in fact, with that particular one, you'll notice a share writing credit with a really good friend of mine who since passed away. But we were samurai brothers, and we saw films together, we wrote feature scripts together. And he had been working at United Artists in the story department. And for whatever reason, he found himself unemployed. So I thought I would help him out, because, you know, I was already getting, a salary as a producer on staff, plus I was getting script fees on top of that. So I offered him a chance to write for animation with me, and we'd share the credit and the fee. And if he enjoyed it enough, then he could go out on his own with two or three scripts as samples and try and get work on his own. I also like the idea that because he wasn't steeped in Transformers or anything like that, that he would be not restricted on the kind of ideas that he would pitch to me. Now, some of them were just too far out there, but some of them were interesting enough. I said, okay, I know how we can make this work for this show in this universe. So the Killing Jar was an idea that started with him. And then we literally sat together in my office every night, side by side, pounding out the script.
Yeah, actually, it plays like what I would think classic science fiction, hardcore science fiction, you know, old Star Trek, the original series kind of premises. Those ideas that it can be in any kind of setting, but the character premises are the same, and the whole point of the plot is like a universal plot, and I think that's why it played so well. So yeah, actually, one of the kind of fun things about that episode is Marissa Fairborn is in that episode, who is, you know, in lore, the daughter of Flint and Lady J. Yeah, which is kind of neat to bring. Once again, there's these little bridges between G.I. Joe and Transformers, and actually Jim, that link the whole universe together. And I really appreciate that Sunbow universe having almost its own continuity at that point. And one of the best things, one of our most enjoyable episodes we have put out is our one on Cold Slither. I know that Ed has some questions about that. We had such
a good time. I did. That was one of my favorite episodes when I was a kid, and I hadn't seen it since I was probably 10 or 11 years old, and until last Sunday when we watched it and reviewed it. And I had an absolute blast. That has aged like wine. It was so much fun to watch. But I've got to know, man, who wrote the Cold Slither song? Because that was that was a gem. That was so much fun to listen to. That was you.
Beautiful.
That's great.
Hats off to you. That I got a text from my ex-wife, who listens to it every week. She goes, thanks to you, that song is stuck in my head. It is one of the best earworms. Yeah, we had such a good time watching that. And it was half of the episode was like a David Lynch movie. I swear, it was the greatest thing to watch. We had such a good time. I mean, you know, Ed, I don't, you want to bring in anything else with that?
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Oh, no, that was all I wanted to say about Cole. I mean, it was, like I said, it was, there was just too much going on. That broke my rating scale. It was so much fun. It was just an absolute blast to watch it. But no, I know. Go ahead. Go ahead. There.
I was going to say, that was another, this happens to me a lot, even in working in in live action. There's always my throwaway ideas are the ones that get chosen. And, you know, I'll work really hard on, you know, five or six ideas that are really well developed. And then I'll just add one last one. It might be two or three lines. And that's the one everyone's, ooh, I like that idea. Let's go with that one. So it was a throwaway idea. You know, it's basically a Pied Piper story. And I turned the script in, and Tom and Joe, well, if you don't know already, Sunbow was a division of an advertising agency out of New York called Griffin Bacall. So Tom Griffin and Joe Bacall, you know, were our bosses on everything. And probably every 4 to 6 weeks, they'd be in LA for some business, and they'd always drop by the office. So on this one Friday afternoon, I think it was Joe, came into my office and said, yeah, we like the script, but where's the song? He said, well, you wrote in the episode that there was going to be a song. We're not going to pay somebody to write it. Now, we were already doing Jim, and I knew that he had contracted songwriters to write all those songs. And so I went, oh, crap, I got to write the song. So over the weekend, fortunately, at the time, I was married to a woman who was a song. She specialized mostly in writing English lyrics for Brazilian songs. Did a lot of work for Sergio Mendes, Manhattan Transfer, sure, a bunch of songs on Sarah Vaughan's last album, which was a Brazilian album that Sergio produced. So, you know, I'd run about all the lyrics by her, and then she wrote the music. I gave her an idea of the sound I heard in my head. And when we submitted it, then Joe says, well, we don't want to use your wife's music because we already have Rob Walsh, you know, under contract right on me. So she was not happy about that. But then I had to do the same thing with Rob, is put together a demo tape, a lot of different music that I heard in my head that I said, this is the sound I'm looking for. And then he wrote the music, which I thought was perfect. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that I was deliberately making fun of heavy metal music because I was not a fan.
No, I think we both picked up on that.
I was in high school in the late 60s, so that's when I came of age of all the music that was coming out. And when I first moved to Southern California, and I'd come up to, before I moved to LA, there were all these great clubs on Sunset Strip where the kind of music that I listened to growing up in Vermont, the actual artists were playing. And then sometime in the mid 80s, all those clubs became heavy metal bands. And so it was my intention to write a bad heavy metal song. And I only recently realized that I failed miserably.
Actually,
those lyrics are great. Those lyrics are, and I mean, you can look at me and tell that on some level I'm into heavy metal music. And I read those lyrics and I was like, I want to cover this right now. This is very over the top, and I like that. So it's very cool. It's I mean, you may have failed parodying metal, but it definitely works. So
it's. Well, it's funny in that way. I think that sometimes the things we try to lampoon the most actually end up being hits or working really well because you understand it to in a level that you can make fun of it. But once, like you said, you failed miserably. And I can honestly say that was one of those episodes of G.I. Joe when I was younger that, of course, when there's, you know, the bad heavy metal being played, my dad would walk in and wonder, like, what are you watching? Like, oh, no, I'm kind of embarrassed. But that it worked so well for that. It aged amazingly well too.
Yeah, and as far as Transformers and G.I. Joe go, I've been out of the loop for so many years. So you and most all the other fans know far more about this stuff than I do, because my area of knowledge was limited to just a few years, and it was so long ago, there's a lot I don't even remember. So I wasn't aware of what kind of following that particular episode had until I stumbled like on Bandcamp. I saw people who were doing covers of it. And then I started seeing, people were making T-shirts. And then I find out that people were making custom Cold Silver action figures. And so my very first G.I. Joe convention was last November in Des Moines, Iowa, at Assembly Required. And every year, I think last year was the 12th, they do a theme. And the theme last year was Dreadnoughts. Friday night, it was Cold Sliver. So they made Cold Sliver T-shirts. They made a Cold Sliver demo tape. A friend of the organizers, who's a copywriter at an ad agency, big fan, he wrote a couple additional verses, which were great, fit right into the verses that I wrote, and then they recorded a brand new version of it. And I mean, it was a surreal experience for me, because I hadn't anticipated the kind of fandom that Cold Sliver had created, but also just being confronted with just seeing Cold Sliver everywhere when I went in the convention. But I had a great time. And when we were talking on the phone about my coming out, I came down to, I just think it would be a missed opportunity for both of us if I wasn't there. And but I had a great time. And it kind of inspired me to want to do more conventions in general, but specifically Joe and Transformer conventions. So
Nice.
I got a couple more lined up this year.
Nice. Very
I
nice. Yeah.
did two Joe conventions. I just did another Transformer a couple weekends ago.
Yeah, TFCon.
And then I'm going to TF Nation in Birmingham, England.
Oh, very nice.
Nice.
Did you have I'd say input, but did you have any kind of creative input with the Transformers the motion picture or the G.I. Joe their motion picture?
Definitely, I don't remember having any, as far as G.I. Joe goes, I don't remember having any discussions with Buzz at all. But with the movie, Flint is really big on crowdsourcing. And so occasionally he would ask us all to come into the conference room, sit around the table, and just spitball ideas. Basically asking anything you've ever wanted to see in a Transformer episode. And he would just pick and choose that stuff. We found something interesting, and he'd put his own spin on it. But that was really the extent of it. I didn't even though I was supervising all the recording sessions for the series, I wasn't even there for the movie, which in a way I was kind of grateful for, because I certainly didn't want to be the one to tell Orson Welles that he was playing the planet.
Okay.
Seems like he was kind of a planet himself.
Okay. Well, I think we're actually running over the time that we agreed on there. We don't want to keep you too much longer, but I did want to ask though, how does it feel that that people, 40 years after you've written this stuff that are still making costumes and nerds like us are doing these cultural archaeology podcasts and just delving into this. I mean, how does that feel after 40 years?
Well, it's a mixture of validation, a little gratitude, but also just kind of overwhelming in the number of people who come up to me and tell me how much a particular thing that I wrote meant to them, and got them through a difficult time. When we were doing a panel at TFCon Los Angeles, you know, a week and a half ago, I forget what the question was asked of me, but I mentioned a particular episode that I had said not many people asked me about, and that was the burden hardest to bear.
Mm-hmm.
I said, for whatever reason, that seemed to resonate less with people than some of the episodes I wrote. But this guy made a point of coming up to me afterwards, before I even left the dais, to tell me how important that particular episode was. And he was going through a difficult time. He was 14 or 15. That was really important. And it's kind of, it's heartwarming. But at the same time, you know, when we're writing these shows, we never imagined anything we were doing would have any impact on anybody. We knew, all we knew was we were doing well in the ratings. And that was it. So our goal, if you want to call it that, was really to sort of entertain ourselves and entertain each other. You know, usually when we pitch a story idea, we start with, wouldn't it be cool if? We were just making it up as we went along. And we did not imagine that it would sort of become the foundation for generations of stories to follow. We just assume, oh, once they pull the plug on this, something new and cool will come along, and that will be the new thing, and nobody will remember Transformers.
You know, I have to say, you know, as a generation, our generation was essentially the latchkey kids, and you know, cartoons and TV shows were kind of, in a way, they were the babysitters. They were the they were there keeping us company when both our parents are working or whatever happened. So, you know, in a way, you know, you kind of you wrote, you know, the entertainment of our childhood. And so I can say definitely I appreciate that. I mean, even to the point where I realized when I was looking at your credits that you worked for the Bozo Show. I mean, that from a young age, those things that that were part of my everyday afternoon life. You know, when I was really young, I went to a daycare center. They'd have the Bozo Show on, and they'd have G.I. Joe Transformers on after that. All these kinds of things all intermingled together. It's almost like you as well as Flint and many others were integral in really what kind of building our imaginations and our creativity from a young age. So I can definitely say I appreciate that.
Well, the Bozo Show is kind of an interesting story. Now, Flint and I and all of our friends at the time, you know, we wanted to write scripts for movies. And the big goal and validation was to become a member of the Writers Guild. That would really prove, you know, you're now part of the club. At the time we were doing animation, none of the animation studios were signatory to the Writers Guild. So we didn't get, you know, health benefits, we didn't get residuals. In fact, I think the only union that any one who worked in animation studio was with the Teamsters. And so, but in some markets, and Chicago was one of them, every day on the Bozo the Clown show, they ran one act of G.I. Joe. And because Claster Television distributed G.I. Joe and Transformers, well, I guess all the shows we were doing, they also were the distributors for the Bozo show. So that was the connection there. So one day I get a fax, a producer on both G.I. Joe and Transformers. that I have to write dialogue for Bozo to recap the episode, the act you saw yesterday, and tee up the act you're going to see today.
I saw a little bit of that actually. That's great. Wow.
So, and because Larry Harmon, who is the original Bozo, owned the rights to Bozo, Larry Harmon Productions was signatory to the Writers Guild. And that is how I was eligible to join the Writers Guild, which never in my wildest dreams did I imagine it would happen for writing dialogue for Bozo.
That's
That's
amazing.
pretty genius though. That's a great way to end. So yeah.
I definitely want to thank you for coming on here and sharing your stories. I mean, these are things that we only guess at over the years, and to hear the stories that you have, it's priceless to someone like me and many others like us. And even to the point you're talking about chainmail with Gary Gygax in a barn, or talking about the how you came up with things for the Bozo Show, the Transformers, all of this is really foundational for our generation. So with that, I have to say thank you very much for your time. This has been wonderful.
I'm
And that is why you prepare everything ahead of time. Ask the guest how long they have and how long they're willing to give you. And as you can see, Michael Charles Hill, he's very generous, and I wish I had known ahead of time. I would have wound down the show, but I'm so glad he stayed along with us. So keep in tuning to this episode, and hopefully we'll keep entertaining you and learning more about the past of Transformers and G.I. Joe. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
I thought we were going to go much longer. So,
Oh, well, I did have there was th stuff that I cut out. I thought we had you for 30 minutes. No, I had to.
I said we were going to do at least a full hour. So,
Oh, well, by all means,
in
then
that
I
case,
will let you continue, Ed.
I had a question. Okay, so I had a question about Space Adventure Cobra.
Okay.
That so I did you do the English translation for that? Is that correct? Okay. When was that? Because I can't find a solid date, because I think there are multiple English versions.
Yeah, there might be. It seems to me, I cannot remember the name of the company that distributed that.
So it would have either been Streamline, or it would have been Manga Entertainment.
No, it was Streamline.
Streamline. And that was with Carl Masick, right?
Right.
Okay.
Carl was a friend of mine. I had worked on a show that he was a co-story editor. I think it might have been Cops.
Okay.
Became,
Loved Cops.
and so I'm guessing I wrote that in 95, 96, somewhere.
Okay, because there was a lot of conflicting stuff about, like, the date that I found on it was 82, but I think that was the original Japanese version, and then there was a UK version that Manga did around the same time, and I think it was a different translation or something like that. But I was a fan of that because there was in the early 90s, there was a singer named Matthew Sweet that used a bunch of clips from that movie in a video that he did prior to it coming out.
Yes, I think I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, great song, fantastic song, not heavy metal, but it really, yeah, he was a real 60s pop sounding kind of guy, and I'm still a fan of him to this day. But when I first saw that video, I was like, what movie is this from? I have to find this. This looks amazing, because that was from a weird time when anime was still, I don't know, it was still kind of underground at that point. It was hard to find, and it wasn't really, there was like there were a few things like Robotech, and Carl Masick did a lot of that kind of stuff around then. But yeah, when it finally came out, I was like, oh, this is finally the movie from the Matthew Sweet video. I was real excited when I finally got my hands on Cobra. So,
Yeah, I think I wrote a few things for Carl that were featured. I know I worked on another Japanese anime show called Saber Rider and the Star Sheriffs.
yes. Okay.
And
Actually, I'm sorry, go ahead.
then I also wrote the pilot episode for Sailor Moon, the English language version. or Deke. But you won't find my name on the credits. They knew that I was capable of doing this kind of work, which is really labor intensive. But you got to go frame by frame. You have a rough translation of the Japanese dialogue, but you've got to come up with a version of it that sounds like something that somebody would say. That's, in the same time frame, and make sure you hit the pops right. So Deke, because they're an American French company. They do a lot of their work in Canada. They had already contracted with Canadian actors and writers to do the Sailor Moon show, but none of their writers could do it. So they asked me, or they hired me, to write the pilot episode and explain to the Canadian writers how to do this. And they paid me more money than what their normal rate was, which was never very good to begin with. They said, but we can't give you credit for it because we've contracted with these Canadian writers. So even though you wrote the episode, your name is not going to be. And I said, that's fine. I didn't necessarily at the time needed to be associated with Sailor Moon, but it's not my thing. Just like Gem was not my thing, but I was coerced into writing an episode.
I didn't know until today that I've never seen Sailor Moon, but I didn't know until today that the character's name on that was Usagi because of her pigtails. I had no idea. But you also worked on a show, a movie called Space Usagi, that was the samurai rabbit in space. Is that that? Yeah,
that was supposed to be a series, and I worked at Mirage Studios.
Mm-hmm.
That means name anything to you? It's the home of
Ninja Turtles.
Yes.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Kevin Eastman, Peter Laird. Is that right? Okay.
So initially, I was working at DC Comics as an editor, and they hired me as a consultant because their agreement with Fred Wolf Films was that they got to review every script and make notes. Now, whether Fred actually ever followed those notes or not, I don't know. Peter and Kevin didn't know anything about animation or writing for anything. So they hired me to be their consultant. So every script that came out of Fred Wolf Studio, they would send to me, I would read it, and I'd make my notes based on what Peter and Kevin told me that they want from them. Less about what they wanted to see, more about what they didn't want to see. And then I would give the notes to Peter and Kevin, and they would review it, and then boom, it would go off to Fred Wolf. So, and they paid me an obscene amount of money to do that per script. And then they had me write a new Bible for the show because they were big fans of the Batman animated series. And felt like, oh, that's the turtle show we want. It's like that. And that ultimately went nowhere. Fred Wolf was not happy about it because most of the world knew the Turtles based on Fred Wolf's animation design. All the licensing was geared toward Fred Wolf animation, not Peter and Kevin's original black and white design.
Right.
And Fred also was getting a nice percentage of licensing as the creator of the animated series. But Judy Price, who was running the children's department at CBS, finally had a meeting with her, made my presentation, and she said, right now, she said, I'm only paying $250,000 per episode for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Warner Brothers spends $500,000 an episode for the Batman series. And we're already the number one rated show. So why would I want to spend $500,000 to be the number one rated show when I could spend $250,000 to be the number one rated show? So that went nowhere. They also hired me to write a Christmas special that we ended up never doing, but it was based on one of their original comic books. So anyway, at some point they decided it would be less expensive to hire me full time than to pay me as a consultant. And they still offered me a lot more money than I was making at DC Comics. So I said yes and moved up to Northampton, Mass. So while I was there, I was under the umbrella of Mirage Studios with Mirage Publishing and Mirage Licensing. So I had two titles. One was creative director for, I think, for licensing, and then director of special projects, which I think was for the publishing part. So they had a half a dozen in-house artists who were working on either directly on the Turtle books that we were publishing, or working on their own their own titles that Mirage was publishing. So I initially started out helping them, you know, pitch their projects around town with no success. At some point, I was asked to come up with a lot of develop ideas for future live action Turtles movies, thinking making them A, evergreen, and B, international, you know, like James Bond. New Line wasn't interested in any of those that I came up with. So then the other thing they wanted me to do is just come up with new non-Turtle projects to pitch to the networks. And the entertainment attorney for Peter and Kevin really thought the way to go was, you know, sci-fi, you know, space stories, but Star Wars was so huge. So Stan Sakai was already a friend of Peter and Kevin. Mm-hmm. So we came up with this idea of doing space sci-fi, which I think existed a little bit in comic book form. So Stan and I took some of the characters that already existed in his universe, and then I created some new characters. And we put together this pitch. I got all the artists, in addition to Stan, inside the studio to chip in and do model designs for new characters. And then working with Fred Wolf, we came up with a 3-minute promo piece of animation to shop around town. And so that, I think, is still available on YouTube. But that's as far as we got, because we ultimately never ended up selling the show. I think we did get maybe Turner licensing on board. But we didn't sell the show because everyone kept saying Bucky O'Hare.
That's exactly what I was about to say. It's real close to Bucky O'Hare, which I liked also. But I was around that time when that came out. I was a massive fan of like independent comics, and I love Sakai's stuff. It was so. Like there's something about the way, like, you know, the stories. I don't know if you ever read those, the original Usagi books, but those were, you know, the stories were real, you know, down to earth, you know, like period accurate samurai dramas that just happened to be, everyone just happened to be drawn like a rhinoceros or a bunny or something like that. I thought they were great. And yeah, how was Stan to work with?
Well, Stan and I already knew each other from my animation days. Stan is great. He's just a wonderful, beautiful person, and love working with him.
Nice.
I kind of wanted to kind of go back a second though with the Sunbow stuff. I know you said obviously at the time it was a lot of throwaway episodes and characters and whatnot, but there was a fun theme that joined Cold Slither and the Gambler together that and it was all the about the working with I guess almost like a mob boss. In the Cold Slither was a very it's a little person in a back of a CD billiards hall or let me see if I can get this correct. Lord Guy Connie. Yes, okay. They were both basically like they would give them we'll give you a loan at a very horrible interest rate. Is there were there any other elements you liked to include with your episodes in that you did between GEM, G.I. Joe, Transformers?
You know, if there is, I probably do not remember them. I mean, it seemed like most of the time, well, it's probably not fair to say I was making it up as I went along, because obviously before I could get to the script stage, I had to plot out everything in the outline stage. So I knew what I was going to be writing beforehand. But maybe any influences I had, one conversation that Flint and I used to have a lot was the kind of backgrounds that we brought to the table. So just with Sunbow alone, you had Steve Gerber, who had a comic book background. So he kind of brought that to the meeting. Flint was more of a games guy, so he brought that to me. And I was a film guy, so I brought that to. So, it's something as simple as, the titles for my episodes. My first idea would always be based on a pre-existing film title or a twist on a pre-existing film, like, 30 Seconds Over Megatron or, well, The Gambler had nothing to do with a few films. Forget the Kenny Rogers film, but I think there was a James Caan film called The Gambler that I think might have come out before I worked on so. And the one at GEM episode I wrote was called Out of the Past. One of my favorite film noirs of Robert Mitchum, even though it has nothing to do with that. But because I'm visually oriented, I just have a stockpile of film images in my head. So maybe, I draw from that more than most people might if they're hardwired to a different kind of background.
Makes a lot of sense with your background. Oh, all right. Well, as we are at an hour here, I am going to go ahead and let you go here. I appreciate all your time and been very generous with your time. And like I told you before, you and many of the writers were instrumental in our development as creative people in our own right. So we appreciate that immensely.
All
And
right.
where are you going? Are your next conventions coming up? I'll let people who listen know that.
I'm scheduled to do a one-day event at SoCal Joe Fest in Temecula, California on, I think it's May 19th. And then Joe Fest in Georgia is June 20th. First, 22nd, 23rd, somewhere around. It's a weekend. I don't remember the specific date.
Where in Georgia is that? That's not far from us at all.
Yeah, I'm in Auburn, so.
Yeah.
Good question. I should Augusta?
Okay.
It's in Augusta. Then also in June, I'm doing a one-day event here in LA called Robo Toy Fest. In August, I will be in Birmingham, England for Transformer Nation. And then in November, I'll be back in Des Moines for Assembly Required.
Excellent. I'm glad you're finally seeing what an impact you had on a lot of people. And what may have just been something to do and something you're trying to as a job back then impact a lot of people. So I'm glad you feel that validation. And
Well, yeah, again, it was just, I was just completely out of the loop for so many years. And also, while I was doing Transformers G.I. Joe, never read the comics because I didn't want to be influenced by their storylines, even
yeah.
subconsciously. And I also found out they never watched the episodes because they didn't So, after I left Sunbow, my tour of duty was up. I just went on and did other things and never really, I didn't run away from it. I wasn't embarrassed about the work. It was just a job I had a certain era in my life. And I went on to do other things and I didn't look back on it. There was nobody in, sort of my life that was interested in. If I had casually mentioned I had worked on these shows, really? So it just sort of became a subject, and I wasn't paying attention to all these conventions that were going. So, yeah, I'm still relatively new to it, and but it's kind of cool.
Yeah, 40th
Nice.
anniversary of Transformers this year, and I mean, it's been a franchise that's really stood the test of time. So, and I know no small part from you as well in there, because a lot of the episodes you wrote are big favorites of mine and many others. So I'm glad of that. So I hope you have a wonderful day there, and I'm gonna let you get on with your day. So thanks so much for being here today. And Ed, if you want to say anything here too.
I got nothing. No, that just thanks for your time. That was amazing. Yeah, great time just talking there.
Great. Well, before we go, I
Oh
just
yeah.
want to make sure, was there any questions you didn't get to ask that you're
Honestly, I went beyond what I had ready for you, so
Same. Yeah. I mean, is there anything else that you want to plug? Do you have any other projects or anything that you want to promote or anything while we got you?
I'm working on this sort of right now secret project for an upcoming convention, but I don't feel I'm not sure I can talk about it yet, but
Fair enough.
that's really about it.
Okay, perfect.
Okay.
Well,
All right.
hopefully that works out well for you then. And have a wonderful day. And thank you so much for being here today.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
All right.
Goodbye then.
Cheers, Michael.